97.9 FM and chapelboro.com present Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, providing interesting guests and topics for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. And now, here's D.G. on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, some of you may remember, some of you have only heard about it, but in 1968, during those terrible times, one of the worst things that happened in our country was the assassination of Robert Kennedy. One of the most poignant things was the carrying of by train of his body from New York down to Washington, where he would be buried beside his brother. And maybe those who remember the event don't remember that along the way, people just lined up beside the railroad tracks and watched the train go by. Well, North Carolina native David Rowell has a book called The Train of Small Mercies, and it's based on that train, but it's a whole bunch of other stories about people who were either gathered to watch the train go by or happened to live nearby the tracks. And David Rowell, thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you.
And for agreeing to talk a little bit about your book. You, of course, grew up in Fayetteville and went to school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, but you lived in Washington for some time now as a deputy editor of the Washington Post magazine.
Right. I've been here 13 years, lived in Boston for 8 years, and actually lived in Durham for 2 years after Boston, where I was at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke.
Well, tell us about your book. Tell us about The Train of Small Mercies.
Right. So this book is really based on a book of photographs. One, I should point out that it's a novel. And it's based on a book of photographs by Paul Fusco. And to tell you how those pictures came to have such a grip on me, take you back to, as you were saying, June 1968. So Robert Kennedy was killed. The Kennedy family decided that they would have a funeral train for him. And that was unusual because, you know, he was a one-term senator who was running for president. And funeral trains were already a rare event in this country anyway. You know, the most famous ones were the Lincoln funeral train, the FDR funeral train. But they really felt like this was the thing that they wanted to do. And so the editors at Look magazine told a staff photographer, Paul Fusco, they said, look, we need someone to shoot the burial at Arlington National Cemetery, so get on that train. And so he did. So just to remind your listeners, and as you were referring to it too, remember Martin Luther King was killed just 2 months earlier, and now Robert Kennedy has been killed. And after Martin Luther King was killed, there were 119 American cities that were just ravaged by riots. You know, the country was just in terrible turmoil. I mean, I'm not a historian, but I think that period is about the darkest period in American history after the Civil War. I mean, it just, the tensions were everywhere. The violence was terrible. And remember, also, this was just 5 years after our president, John Kennedy, was killed. Incredibly violent time. And so, you know, people didn't really know what to expect with the funeral train. Now, it was publicized, and newspapers ran the maps of the train's route. But So Fusco got on the train, and he really wasn't prepared to shoot anything before he got to Arlington. But as soon as the train came out of Penn Station, came out of that tunnel, he was really moved to see Americans shoulder to shoulder, African Americans standing next to white, young and old, curiosity seekers, women whose mascara was running because they were in tears, and you know, he saw miles and miles of unbroken mourners. And so immediately he lifted the window from his train and stuck his camera out and began shooting. Now, estimates are anywhere from 500,000 to 2 million people lined up to see the train on that day. But, I mean, that's certainly one of the most public displays of grief in American history. So now the train was supposed to be a four-hour journey to Arlington Cemetery, but it met with tragedy in New Jersey. There were crowds everywhere, and in Elizabeth, New Jersey, the crowd was overflowing, and a train coming from Chicago came careening around the corner, and the engineer slammed on brakes, but he couldn't stop the train in time, and it plowed into a crowd. and two people were killed. And then soon after, in Trenton, there was a man who was on top of a train car, and you know, his hands just kind of idly went up. He had a good view, and his hand gripped a 10,000-volt cable.
Oh, wow.
And he was, at the time, he was pronounced dead, or the Kennedy family or the people in charge thought he was dead and pronounced him dead. In fact, he did survive, and in fact, the Kennedy family would go on to pay his medical bills for many years. But so that, you know, it's just a terrible start to this already very sad procession. And so they said, look, if this, you know, this can't happen, all the other trains have to be stopped. We can't go at this speed. And so what was going to be a 4-hour train ride became an 8-hour train ride. Now, for Paul Fusco, what that meant was he had more time to shoot. And so by the time the train pulled into Union Station in Washington, he shot over 1,000 pictures.
Wow. And this is long before digital, so he had to have 36 frame film or
yes.
something that he's having to load and reload. And
right. I mean, he just worked the whole time. Now, you know, he just saw such a panorama of Americans. You know, here were choirs, and here were women who literally fell to their knees as the train passed, and here were women, mothers with curlers in their hair and toddlers on their hips, and Boy Scouts, and old military men who had stuffed themselves into their suits long after retirement and gave a crisp salute as the train passed, and you know, just groups of kids and nuns and factory workers, and you know, just I mean, particularly kind of blue collar America, because Robert Kennedy was a real champion of the, you know, the poor and the middle class, and so they really turned out in great volume. So
well, this inspires your story, but this is not your story.
So Fusco showed these pictures to his editors at Look magazine, and he was happy with them, and they said, you know, and they were a weekly magazine, and they said, well, you know, these are good, but boy, by the time we bring these out, they it's going to feel like old news, so we think we won't run them. And, you know, he was a staff photographer, so he had to move on. So he kept those photographs in shoeboxes under his bed for about 30 years. And in the late 90s, he produced a volume called RFK Funeral Train, a small collection of the photographs. And I saw them soon after, and they just really knocked me out. I mean, they gripped me. And part of the effect of those pictures is you feel like you're on the train, because every one of those people is looking up at you, you know, because they saw this guy with the camera out the window, and they looked up, and that fleeting second, he caught them. So I just studied them for years, and when I got to the point where I was starting to think, I'd been writing short stories for a long time, and starting to think, you know, that maybe it was time to try my hand at a novel, which was a decision I didn't come into easily, because I really loved the short story form, and I never thought, you know, my heroes were Raymond Carver, great short story writer, and so I didn't read many novels, I didn't want to write a novel, but at some point I thought, well, I don't know if that plan is working out so well, because I didn't have a book. So I said, okay, well, if I am going to write a novel, I need to approach it like a short story writer. And so I was focused on the form of the thing that I was going to write first. And I said, okay, well, so it would be maybe a series of linked stories so that I could write, you know, what I felt was my strength in short stories, but ultimately they could add up to something larger. And so I asked,
I don't want to accuse you of tricking us, but what you're looking for and what other short story writers are doing is to say, I love short stories. I think that I can make a long set of stories that relate to each other, are strung together so that it's in the form of a novel, but that each story still sort of stands on its own in a way.
I'm sure on some level I was trying to have it both ways. You know,
yeah.
I was trying to write a book that I could call a novel, because I thought that would be a better bet, that I'd have a better chance of publishing it. But I went into it thinking, you know, it's going to be short stories. Now, by the time I was done with it, I was really stunned to feel like I had truly written a novel. But it's not a traditional novel. It's, as you say, there's six narratives going on at the same time. The novel all takes place on this day, June 8th, 1968. And because the train traveled from New York to New Jersey to Delaware to Pennsylvania to Maryland to Washington, you know, it had six states. So I felt like, and one of the first decisions I made was that I'd have six narratives, six groups of characters who set out to see the train in those six places.
Well, I tell you what, we're visiting with David Rowell, and we're talking about his book, The Train of Small Mercies. When we come back, maybe we can get him to tell us a little bit about one or two of those characters that are featured in the stories that are a big part of his book. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on 97.9 FM, WCHL. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is David Rowell. He's the author of The Train of Small Mercies. If you joined us late, David Rowell is a native of Fayetteville, went to school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and is now the deputy editor of the Washington Post magazine. David, you told us a little bit about how you got into this. You got into this story, this string of stories, or this set of stories, or the that turned into a novel. But it's very much character centered, and I don't know. You know, I would love to have you talk about any of these people. One of the
sure.
guys who intrigues me is Lionel. Mm. And who will you? Anyway, he's the son of of one of these typical porters on the train, who made a black guy who's made his career, you know, as sort of the uniformed host on the train. But and this is a guy who's been educated in North Carolina, maybe at Winston-Salem State or
right.
one of the historically black schools, he's a modern guy for 1968, trying to work his way into a profession that's not so modern. I don't know. Well, tell us about Lionel.
Yes, right. So Lionel's story is the New York story. It starts in New York, and right, Lionel's father is a longtime Pullman porter, and is retired because of health issues. But he's pulled some strings and has gotten Lionel a summer job as a porter on the train. Now, it just so happens that Lionel has been assigned this train that's taking Robert Kennedy's body to Arlington National Cemetery, and so his parents are very proud of him for that. And Lionel doesn't fully understand just exactly the scope of the day and what he's in for. And then one of the things that's on Lionel's mind is, it's a distraction for him, is he's just received a letter from his girlfriend and in which she told him that she was pregnant. And so he has not been able to talk to her, and he's desperate to talk to her, but he has to get through this day first. And what Lionel is trying to do, another thing that's always on his mind, is Lionel is trying to bring out the first African-American comic book superheroes. He's been filling his notebooks with sketches and storylines and characters for all these years, but in 1968 you really didn't see black superheroes yet. I mean, they were coming very soon, but Lionel wants to be the first to usher them in. So you have all these things going on, and Lionel gets on the train, and these porters that he's working with, they've been working on the train for a long time, and they don't take so kindly to a kid, basically, who's just doing it for a summer job, because usually those jobs were not, you couldn't really get those jobs as summer jobs, but so they don't mind giving him a hard time of it, and also because he's going to college, and there's a little bit of tension there because these guys have worked on the train their whole adult lives, and so they're not past giving him some ribbing and making it a little tough for him.
The other part of it is that he's distinct from these guys that he's working, these older guys that he's working from, but you also have him encountering sort of the typical street African American guys of the 1968s who are
right.
on the border of, they're a cross between working hard to burn down the city in order
yeah.
to bring about civil rights, or just to burn down the city so they can loot and beat up people.
Lionel's never been to Washington before, and And, you know, in Washington has just been, parts of Washington have just been torched. As one of the conductors says, you know, it looks worse than what I saw in World War II, and I would know because I was there in France. And so when Lionel gets there, he's so desperate to reach his girlfriend by payphone that the other porter said, come on, look, we're going to take you out for a drink, and we'll see if we can find a bartender who would serve a face that young. But he really just wants, I mean, the day has been overwhelming. He really just wants to be on his own. And they say, look, you know, a young black man here in Washington can have a hard time right now, so you need to be smart, and you need to avoid this area and this area. And so they let him go with some trepidation, but trouble does find Lionel. He's walking around Washington, and he ends up in a situation where he finds a couple of girls who have been stood up, and they like him because he's in a uniform and he looks respectable.
He's got this finely pressed, even though he's been working all day long, he's got this really good-looking uniform, and he's a young, good-looking guy.
Right, right. And so they take a shine to him pretty immediately, and then the two guys who were supposed to be the date show up, and they don't look like Lionel. And so the girls are quite taken with him, and they say, well, you know, you guys can get lost, and these guys don't like that. And that's where some difficult issues play out there.
Well, I don't want to tell your whole story, but the thing that got me was here's a situation where an African-American in 1968 has got a uniform that sets him apart from everybody else, and also is sort of his key to being a part of the club of Pullman Porters.
Right.
And in the aftermath of this, he's in total disarray, and his uniform is not, if not destroyed, it is, he can't work in that uniform.
Right, he finds himself to be in a pretty vulnerable situation. You know, there is some violence in that story, and it just felt, given everything that was going on in the country in writing this novel, I knew that some violence was going to come into the larger story. But also the reason I created Lionel as a character is because I needed one character who could, for the purpose of the novel, show exactly what was going on the train tracks. You know, who could be that witness to all these Americans and this tableau of grief, because all these other characters that I write about in the book, they came based on particular pictures or details in pictures, but I needed one character who basically could stand in for, or who could help usher in the fuller scope of the whole book, Paul Fusco's pictures. And so putting someone on the train made a certain kind of sense to me.
Well, I was interested and speculated about where did you come up with this character? Well, he's not a particularly of your time frame, not of your ethnic background. You've got him living, you know, he's a New York guy.
Yeah.
Where did you come up with him?
Well, you know, thinking about who was working on the train in 1968, I mean, a very large majority of the fellas who were porters and servicemen on the train were African American, so that was not such a leap. But one of the details about Lionel, this notion of wanting to write and create African American superheroes, came pretty directly from my experience. I'm an editor at the Washington Post, but occasionally I've gone out and written a magazine story for the Washington Post magazine, and the first story I did was about an African American man who was legally blind. But his dream was to create his own comic books and characters, and so he had a lot of African American characters. And I spent a lot of time with him and his creative partner, and I was just very moved by his story and his dream. Basically, he had spent his whole adult life trying to produce comic books and characters, and you know, the challenge that he was legally blind was to me pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
So you know, that's true. I mean, that's a case where reporting just really, you know, you take some things that you've witnessed as a reporter and you put them through a fictional lens, and so that was part of the creation of Lionel.
Wow, what a character. We're visiting with David Rowell. He's the author of The Train of
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, a special presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL. Find this and all other episodes of Who's Talking on WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. And now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with David Rao. David is the author of The Train of Small Mercies. If you joined us late, David grew up in Fayetteville, came to Carolina for his education, and then has been working as a journalist, a writer, an editor ever since. Right now, for some time, he's been the deputy editor of the Washington Post magazine. But we're talking about his book. And David, a great character, Lionel, you've brought us up today. I mean, we could pick any of the others. One of those that grabbed me was seemed to be based on maybe a real character. This is the Irish nanny.
Uh-huh.
I guess you say her name, Maeve?
Yeah, Maeve.
McDurden. Uh-huh. And she's come to New York to interview for a position with Ethel Kennedy. Just,
right.
but not taking into account the death. She's there because this was going to be a regular interview in her mind. And then she gets caught up in all of this. Where in the world? Well, tell us about her and tell us where in the world she came from.
Well, Maeve's story, that was the last one that I wrote, and I, you know, none of the characters have a direct connection to Robert Kennedy, and that was, you know, that was by design. I was interested in writing about ordinary Americans, and Maeve is, but it's true. You think about all the talk of Irish American and being Catholic that John Kennedy brought into focus when he ran for president, and then Robert Kennedy. I thought, you know, as I knew I wanted a diverse group of characters with lots of backgrounds, and somehow writing about an Irish American felt right for me. And so I thought about well, what if this was someone, you know, how can I tie this character more directly into Robert Kennedy's story and Robert Kennedy family? And so, you know, Robert Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy had a lot of children. And so as I was reading about him and thinking about their lives, I thought, well, you know, they need people to help take care of those children. And so I thought, well, what if we had a character who had interviewed with the Kennedy family and that had gone well, and so you had a second interview scheduled, and she's come down from Massachusetts where she's been working, and she's come down to, you know, to hope, secure the job, only to find out that this is what has happened, and what would her situation look like. And the reason, one of the ways I got onto her character was, you know, in almost all these instances of creating characters, I took my cues from the photographs, and at the very end of Paul Fusco's book, as the train is pulling into Union Station, you have pictures very unlike all the others. Maybe it's because of the exposure. But they're very dreamy, and the characters are very fuzzy, and you have this colorful wash going across the pictures. And to me, it conjured up a kind of unconsciousness. And I thought, what if you had one of these characters who've been waiting for you, the train to pull into the Union Station all this time? And maybe it was the heat, maybe it was standing up all this time, maybe it was just the sheer anticipation. But what if that character fainted and didn't actually make it to see the train? And so, you know, part of this is all just kind of asking yourself questions and putting layer upon layer of possible information on there. So I thought, okay, well, if I have this person who's in Union Station and she faints before the train can come, well, that gives me one more thing to, you know, to work with. And so, and I was also interested just in this, Maeve's backstory is that her father was a great storyteller and ran a pub, and Maeve thought, basically, in the classic Irish tradition, but Maeve thought that telling stories in the way that he did was just about the best thing you could do with your life, and so she became a storyteller herself, and she would entertain the customers as a young girl, and she would just make up these fantastic stories, and he was very proud of her, and this was this great bond they had between them. And then her father died very suddenly while she was still young, and that basically shut Maeve down very dramatically. And I think there's a line in the book that says, you know, after that, she just kind of walked through the hallways of her school as if waiting for her life to be over. And so she's just had a great trauma, and she's just looking for some purpose in life, and taking care of babies and children has been it for her.
David, with all of this backstory, I mean, did this must have threatened to be a novel, or she must have threatened to have been the lead character in a novel, one of these Ireland to the United States, and how you get along, kind of. Because you know a lot about, I mean, you've imagined a lot about this person.
Well, here's the thing. If I was going to have all these characters, and there are about 30 major and minor characters in the book, and it's not a terribly long book. So each character really has to come alive on the page. And you know, there's only so much that can happen in a single day. If you think about your own life, most days are not eventful, even when there is a major event. So you don't always have the great story arc to work with. And so I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to bring these characters through and you're just going to see them on this one day, part of the way I can hopefully make readers care about these characters is to really invest in their backstory so that you have some sense of what they've been through and where they're coming from. And so that was actually great fun to have all these characters and to fully imagine their backstories.
Did you ever meet anybody for real, like Maeve?
No. I didn't. And, I mean, there was a woman that helped raise me when I was growing up in Fayetteville, and I had a profound affection for her. And so, I mean, that may have, hadn't really honestly thought about it until you asked that question. But I think the idea of writing about a nanny or a woman who was in charge of taking care of the children, because that woman is never so far from my mind, you know, it may be that was the way that she kind of worked her way into the book.
What you have to do with Maeve, because although we haven't talked about it, you have her in Washington, sort of in the a single woman.
Yeah.
So, you know, people. She's not a beauty queen or anything, but she's okay, and men are hitting on. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of potential action going on, and you have to write from her point of view about what happens when how a woman reacts to different kinds of approaches from men,
right.
And then how a lonely woman feels when she's in a city by herself. And how do you know what goes on in a woman's mind?
Well, you know, I was raised by a woman. I married a woman. So, you know, I feel
and
like,
so you talk about these things with these women that you know.
No. But I, you know, I've always had women who were close friends and men who were close friends, and you know, I think that if you're a writer, you've always generally tried to be a listener and an observer, and I think, you know, I mean, I think anyone who's, as William Maxwell said, anyone who has survived childhood has a lifetime of writing to do.
And right.
So, you know, you take relationships that you've gone through and you mind them in some ways, and you also imagine other things. And, I mean, you know, in this novel, I wanted each character to be very different from the other. And so Maeve is a young single woman, and her story is quite different from, say, Dolores's. Dolores's story is the one that's set in Pennsylvania, and Dolores is married and has three children. And the situation with her is she has... And this was the case, you know, it was said that if you didn't like John Kennedy, you hated Robert Kennedy.
Right,
And Dolores feels great sympathy and affection for Robert Kennedy, and particularly Ethel. She's the one character in the book who's very focused on Ethel. But she has a husband who absolutely hated Robert Kennedy, and he'd said to her, you know, at one point before Kennedy was killed, he said, "Boy, I wouldn't mind taking a swing at those big Kennedy teeth of his."
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, Kennedy kind of... He had that impact. He could just seduce a crowd, and 20,000 people would just swoon with what he said. And then there were other people who felt like he had been handed everything, and you know, and really had. And remember, Kennedy was speaking out against the Vietnam War, even though he had helped shape it. And some people felt that that was very un-American. And Kennedy talked a lot about racism and the need for civil rights, and there were certainly people in America, and certainly people in the South, who did not like those points of views being expressed like that. So Dolores has a husband who's controlling and very disapproving of Kennedy, and would have said to her, had she told him of her plans to go see the train, you know, no wife of mine is going to go see that train. And so Dolores has taken her youngest child, her daughter, and basically created a series of lies for themselves so that they can sneak out and join her other more liberal friends to see the train. And Dolores's story is probably the most tragic in the book, because the lies that Dolores tells, they start to complicate things for her, and they kind of catch up to her. And
well, it's an interesting story that these characters seemed contemporary to me, because just as in the 1960s, the Kennedys divided us into wild admirers and people who were whose opinion of the Kennedys bordered on real rank hatred.
Yes.
You transfer that sort of feeling, and it would be within families, particularly between man and wife, mm-hmm. and you transfer that to the modern attitudes of people down here, or I guess all over the country, about President Obama, and you'll find families divided like this, where the husband who's struggling in business thinks of Obama as an enemy to business, and then you have the wife who's won over by Obama's charisma and by his attention to the downtrodden, but. In modern times, it would be harder for the husband to say to the wife,
yes.
Hey, you ain't going to see the train, or you ain't going to see the president.
That's
but
right.
Back in 1968, that was a time of transformation, and still husbands could boss their wives around.
Right, right. Well, you're always, as a fiction writer, you're always looking for points of tension. And so this was the one family in the book that was very divided, and so... You know, that certainly felt like that gave me something to work with. And as I say, she was very connected to Ethel. I mean, Dolores' identity is as a mother. And she thinks about all these children that Ethel, as she imagines, is going to have to raise by herself. And she's just crushed. You know, she wonders, well, are all these children going to ride back with Ethel, on the train? You know, and so she's just very focused on Ethel's grief.
We're visiting with David Rowell about his book, The Train of Small Mercies, and he and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on 97.9 FM, WCHL. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with David Rowell about his book, The Train of Small Mercies. David grew up in Fayetteville, went to college at Chapel Hill, has been editing, writing, and becoming the author of his book, The Train of Small Mercies. He now his day job is deputy editor of the Washington Post magazine, and he's talking to us from Washington. David, thanks again for sharing with us your book.
Sure.
You know, you and I have talked about your job, though, we've been talking to you as a author, but your day job is an editor, and how are the roles different?
Well, you know, in some ways, I mean, the way I talk about fiction and the ways I talk about nonfiction are not very different. I mean, at the Post magazine, what we're trying to produce is literary journalism, narrative nonfiction. And so when I'm talking to writers, I'm using the same terms in a lot of ways, characters and story arc and scenes. And, you know, I might say, well, I'm not sure enough happens here. Or I might say, I feel like we need another character to fill out this story. And so... So I want the reader to read these pieces as if he or she was reading a short story. I want the reader to be moved in that way. These stories, if we're doing it right, these stories go somewhere, and they show a character who, at the end of the piece, is different from the way he or she was at the beginning of the piece. So, you know, in some ways, there's a lot of similarity, at least in the way that I approach it. I mean, the difference for me is as much... talking about that and editing and all that I'm doing during the day, those are ultimately the other writer's pieces. And
yeah, but you don't sound like a newspaper editor. You sound like a fiction editor, a literary
editor. You know, I'm not. I would never refer to myself as a newspaper editor. One, because I've never edited a newspaper story, really. I've always been a magazine editor my whole career, and And so, yeah, the way it is true that the way I talk about stories is a little bit different from the way that some of the other editors, and, you know, because we're dealing with different issues, but sometimes it's true that there's a reporter who will write a magazine story, and if it's the first time, I think I might I might be a little bewildering as we first start to talk about the piece, because I'm explaining it in a way that's different generally from that reporter has been used to hearing an editor talk about a story.
Well, so David, you've got a newspaper, you've entered into a contract, or you've asked a regular journalist, somebody who writes for a newspaper, to write a magazine piece for you, and anticipating the different styles that you would expect, tell us in summary what you would say to him or her, to sort of help get that person started on something that is going to be what you want rather than what his newspaper editor would want.
Well, I think one of the chief differences is the use of scene. Generally, in newspaper pieces, you might have a few fixed moments, but you don't have a long scene that just kind of unfurls for a while. And for us, scenes are really the building blocks. I mean, they're the building blocks for all stories, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. But that's the first thing I'm trying to get the reporter to understand is if things are going to happen and we're going to care about this character, the only way we can really do it is if you show us versus tell us. And the only way you can show us is show the character doing something. I mean, generally, a magazine story is ultimately a character trying to get somewhere, a character at a crossroads, a character trying to accomplish something. And so you have to be with that character at the very beginning of that journey. So, you know, whatever the story is and whatever the situation is, you have to spend weeks with that character. You know, we're not talking about pieces that get created by a few interviews and some background and some fact-checking. I mean, we're really talking about immersing in the character's life. But that, to me, is a really thrilling form of journalism, because you get to bring those people as fully to life as, you know, as nonfiction techniques let you do. So that's generally how I'm spending my days, is working with writers, coaching them through that, you know, often complicated process.
Are there some rules about magazine writing, like the kind of magazine writing that you want to edit, as to, you know, you say, sometimes you see, you want a first paragraph that's really going to grab you. and do you say that to them? And then how do you, or if you, well, let, first of all, is that something you say to your writers?
Well, it's true that I'm sometimes used to reporters and writers who feel like they have to kind of tell you the whole story right from the beginning. And I will say, no, it's a magazine story. Let's slow down. Don't tell me anything in the beginning. Just show me something. You know, let's have some thing happen, some development, some point of tension. You can always fill me in on the backstory later, but hook me with character.
Tell me something about a place or about a person that is going to be interesting and make me want to know more. I mean, is that... Give me an example. I mean, what would be...
Well, let's see. So, gosh, so many stories
You've done 1,000 of these.
Right. Well, an example, another North Carolinian, Wells Tower, and I worked on a bunch of Washington Post cover stories, and one story we did was a story at the last of the old horse track gamblers.
Wow.
Guys who would go to a horse track, study all the tiny bit of information, and put money down on a horse. See, that mostly has been replaced by all the TVs and computers and everything else. And so Wells went and found a horse track here in Laurel, Maryland, where there was a young guy, about 20 years old, and he was doing it. He was surrounded by a bunch of 70-year-old horse track gamblers.
Uh-huh.
And so this guy was a real student. But he, you know, he was from a completely different generation. And so, and whether he was necessarily addicted to gambling, or I mean, the story was about what hold the horse track gambling had on him, and how he went about it, and where it got him, basically. And so Wells spent a whole lot of time with that character. And so, you know, one of the great thrills is you don't always know what you're going to find. Wells and I just started with the premise of going to find the last of the old horse track gamblers. You know, that was the way we kept referring to it. And then the great thrill was that he found someone who didn't fit the idea of what we thought that might be. So
And what was his first paragraph like? What did you tell him to start?
I think that he showed the character. He was hitting his thigh with his sheets because his horse was losing, he thought the horse was going to do really well, and so he's coming. Come on, come on, come on!
Oh, I love it.
And so, you know, I don't need to know anything else beyond that moment because here's a character in some anguish, right?
Wow.
There's a thing happening. There's a point of tension. He's watching his horse. His horse is doing well. Now his horse is fading. Now he's lost. He's lost some money. Something's already transpired. And so, as a way to start off the piece, it was action. I mean, I'm always looking for action.
Well,
and so that was one way to do it.
Well, I'm learning, and I hate to cut us off, but the time's up, and we've got to stop. But David Rowell, thanks for your book, The Train of Small Mercies, and taking time to talk with us about that book and its characters, and also an inside look at what your day job is like editing these great pieces for the Washington Post magazine. Thanks.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
And thanks to you for listening to this has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.